everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Moe Gamer Podcast. We're going to continue following our more sort of casual format, so we haven't really got a sort of fixed topic we want to talk about today. We're just going to talk a little bit about the things we've been enjoying of late and the things that we might be enjoying in the near future and so on. I am Pete Davison of ricedigital.co.uk and moegamer.net and this YouTube channel if you happen to be watching on YouTube. And joining me, as always, is my good friend Chris Caskey. How are you doing today?
Oh, trying to keep cool, and I imagine it's the same for you.
Pretty much, yeah. Yeah, at the time of recording earlier in this week, we had like the worst heat wave we've had since the 1970s. So of course there's everyone going, back in 1970 we managed this day problem. It's like, yeah, I'm sure you did, but you know, it's still not very nice.
Yeah, like, what is it with boomers where it's like, we suffered this thing, so you have to suffer. Doesn't just because you suffered it doesn't mean it didn't suck. I'm sure you were bitching about it back when it was happening.
Yeah, exactly. And I bet portable air conditioners weren't as easy to come by back then as well. But even with suitable technology, combine that with the cost of living crisis that we're suffering over here right now, and there's the intense feeling of guilt every time you turn the air conditioner on right now.
Yeah, with energy, what it is. Yeah. It's like, yeah, we used to suffer through heat like that. Yeah, you also used to think cigarettes were like a good anxiety medication. So like, yeah. Turns out you don't have to do everything the same.
Never did me any harm. Did it? Did it not? Are you sure? Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
My grandpa, right? Like, I smoked 80 years. I don't understand why it's such a big deal. I fucking died of emphysema.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Exactly. Anyway, I'm sure we got lots of things to talk about today. I think the first thing I would like to mention, if you don't mind me going first, I would like to talk a little bit about the Anbernic Win 600.
Oh yeah, I'm super curious to hear some more details on this bad boy.
Yeah, so this is a device that has been launched by Anbernic, or however you pronounce them, who are a Chinese manufacturer, mostly of sort of emulation handhelds up until this point. But the Win 600 is their entry into the handheld PC market. So it's sort of a competitor to the Steam Deck. But in terms of specs, it's a bit more low end than the Steam Deck. So you won't expect to be running quite as impressive stuff on this as you would be able to on a Steam Deck. But it's also slightly less expensive. It's arguably, in some people's eyes, a little bit expensive for the tech you do get in there. But there was also a launch discount that made it very reasonably priced when I picked it up. So I'm very happy with it. What it is, basically, it's a handheld device, sort of a roughly the size of a Switch in handheld mode, but quite a bit thicker and heavier. And straight out of the box, it will boot up into Windows 10. And then optionally, you can add stuff to it as you see fit, because it's just a PC. So there's no sort of proprietary firmware or anything on there. You can just customize it as you see fit. So if you want to install Steam OS on there and make it work like a Steam Deck, you can do that. Likewise, if you want to install a retro specialist operating system on there, like Butterserra, which is one that I've discovered recently, you can do that too. And you can even dual boot it so that the internal storage boots to Windows, and then like an external USB stick has all your retro stuff on it as well. So that's the setup I've got. So I can boot into either Windows to play stuff on Steam or stream stuff from my main computer, or I can boot into retro mode and have access to all of the myriad ROMs and stuff that I've got everywhere. And it's fantastic. It's a fantastic device. It's got a lovely IPS screen that's nicely sized. The performance in emulation is wonderful in Butterserra, because that's a very lightweight operating system that's designed to not have any crap running in the background, so it means that it can give all its attention to the emulators. So everything I've thrown at it so far has run absolutely beautifully, including Neo Geo stuff, which can be a pain to get running sometimes. I've only tried up to PS1 so far. Supposedly it will handle Dreamcast and GameCube and even up to Wii U very well. The only weak spot in its emulation lineup is supposedly PS2, but that's supposedly a bit of a bugbear for emulation handhelds and specialist devices like this generally. So I'm not too concerned about that.
Computer, unless you're a genius.
Yeah.
I still can't get Nano Breaker to run.
Yeah. Exactly. And I'm not too concerned about that because, I've still got working PS2s anyway, so like multiple of them. So I'm not too worried about that for the moment. But it's something that I'm sure will improve in the future. So, yeah, I mean, is there anything in particular you would like to know about it?
You kind of covered most of my curiosity, in terms of capabilities there. So I guess for me, like console trash that I am, ease of use. Like, I've been looking at the Invernic products for a long time. And and to me, like, one that's basically a handheld PC wasn't super appealing to me because I'm more... Like, I would rather just have one of, like, the proprietary emulation-focused ones. Like, I don't know if I care about the Windows features. So, but then again, like, obviously, being Windows, it opens up a lot of opportunities to install Steam, play some of those lo-fi indie games that I love on it.
Yeah.
You sent me a screenshot of Holocure running on that bad boy. If I could get Vampire Survivors and Holocure running on a handheld, I'd be a pretty happy boy. So, those possibilities start to be more attractive to me. But as someone who's just bad with computers, well, I don't know if I'm better than most people I know personally with computers, but I'm nowhere near the internet grade computer wizardry. As someone who prefers console gaming specifically because I hate fiddling with computer games to get them to look and run properly, what would my experience be like with this thing? Like, would I have to be...
Well,
I don't want to buy a device where I basically have to be on Google chat with you every time I want to do something.
It's certainly not like that. As long as you're going with the proper expectation, you're not going to be running AAA stuff on here. You're not going to be running recent 3D heavy games on here. That said, anything that there's from sort of the Xbox 360 era that there's a PC port of seems to run quite well. So, for example, I downloaded the PC version of Blur and played it on it, and it was happily running along at 60 frames a second, no problem.
Oh, that's nice.
So, like, stuff from, like, 5 to 10 years ago or something, you could probably get running. But it's probably best to focus, as you say, on the more sort of lo-fi indie games and so on.
Oh, like Wrecketeer. Can I run Wrecketeer on this thing? Can I run...
I haven't actually tried it, but I suspect you would be able to, yeah.
Torchlight 2. Stuff like that. That's the kind of stuff I play on PC anyway. Like, I'm not playing crazy stuff on PC. I'm playing, like, weird...
Yeah.
Weird shit.
Well... The nice thing that I've found is I did try and install Warriors Orochi 3 on the device to see if it ran, and it just ran too slowly to be playable. It was reasonably smooth, but it was sort of running at half the speed it was supposed to.
Okay.
But then I tried using Steam's built-in streaming system to stream it from my main computer to the handheld, and it ran beautifully that way.
Cool.
So that is an alternative. If you've got a gaming PC that is... up to the job of running something well and streaming it over your home network, then that is an option. So if you want to, like, play Warriors Orochi in bed or something like that, you can do.
Yeah, that's a very interesting proposition.
Yes, exactly, because I primarily pick this device up to use as, like, a visual novel machine for visual novels that don't get console releases. So not just 18-plus stuff, but there are some visual novels that just only get released on PC regardless. So that's the main reason I picked it up. But the fact it runs indie games quite nicely, the fact it streams games from Steam quite nicely is a happy bonus. And then, like I say, the retro gaming performance, it involves a little bit of setting up in the first place that is vaguely technical. But if you just follow the instructions that are on the Butacera website, they're very step-by-step and specific, and working on the assumption that people haven't really done this a lot before and might need some help along the way.
Okay.
The only bit of fiddling I had along the way was when first setting up Butacera. It has a lot of these devices seem to make a sort of strange assumption about the way your monitor is oriented. It seems to assume that your monitor is vertically oriented for some reason. So that required a tiny bit of tweaking to get working. That basically involved copying a script file onto a USB stick. But again, there were full instructions on how to do that on Butacera's website, because they know that's an issue and they know how to fix it. So as long as you follow those instructions, you're fine.
Okay.
Which is good. And then after that, it's just a case of copying the stuff you want over onto it or installing it through Steam. In the Windows 10 mode, you can run Steam in big picture mode, so it basically works like a console when you're in that mode anyway. You can add stuff that is external to Steam very easily, and then run it through Steam Big Picture Mode. So, yeah, you can basically make it work like a console. And when it's not working like a console, it's a Windows PC, so it's pretty intuitive to use anyway. So,
does it have like an on-screen keyboard?
Yes, okay. Yes. So there's a touch screen. When you tap on a text field, it will pop up an on-screen touchscreen keyboard. And there's also a button on the side that allows you to pop up a keyboard at any time as well. So, okay.
Yeah, it sounds really neat. You've been telling me about these Invernic products for a while. Because I think you had like a Game Boy-styled one, right?
Yes. So I've got the RG351V, which is the Game Boy-shaped one. If you're just after something that will play retro games well, there are much cheaper ways of doing that, even from Anbernic's range. But if you think the flexibility of being able to put Windows on there as well will be useful, it's definitely worthwhile.
Yeah, I'll have to do some digging into their catalog of products. I mean, I know I have before, but I just never pulled the trigger on anything. I definitely like some of the kind of like more petite ones with like the aluminum housings and stuff. So like,
yeah,
this thing for me is going to be loaded up with like GBA games and like Genesis shmups. So like, I don't know if I need to really commit that hard, but either way, I do want to get my hands on one of these eventually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. Because I mean, we talk about how nice it is to have our curated collections on the Evercade and the Switch and so on as well. But it's also nice to have one of these sort of retro boxes easily available so that you can easily access the stuff that doesn't get re-released, the stuff that is unlikely to get a re-release, like licensed games and that sort of thing. So, it's a good thing to have in your pocket for when you need it. So, yes, I recommend the experience.
Yeah, well, very cool. Yeah, something to keep in mind. All right.
Right, so what would you like to tell us about today?
Oh, I don't know. I've kind of started exploring the vast catalog of indie games that I've been amassing for the Switch and the PS4 kind of in the past few months while I've been sucked into Final Fantasy XIV, like this giant amassing pile of shame. So, I've had an opportunity to dig into some cool stuff, and some of it's kind of not news, some of it's kind of stuff people already know is great, but like, I think we would be remiss if we didn't take some time to talk about how great Metal Max Xeno Reborn is.
Yep.
Yeah, so I've been taking some time to play Metal Max Xeno Reborn, which is a kind of reboot of Metal Max Xeno, which came out a few years ago, which got quite a bit of negative feedback. So they, you know, the developers were good enough to kind of take a roll back and kind of rebuild it from the ground up, you know, keeping what worked, ditching what didn't, and kind of restructuring the game a bit. For people who aren't super familiar, Metal Max is actually a pretty long-running franchise. It's just not one that's ever gotten a tremendous amount of play in the U.S. So
I think we've had what, two installments prior to this one? I think there was one on the PS2 era, wasn't there? I think
that's pretty much that came it. Out. it was the PS2 one, which I think was the third or fourth one, and then it was Xeno was the second one we got after that, to my knowledge. So we got Metal Max, the original one, was 1991. This was ancient, you know. This is on the Famicom, so we're talking about a series with a pretty storied history, and we just haven't gotten a lot of it in the States. I'm trying to look at the history of it now, and I'm trying to figure out which is the one we got on the PS2.
We got Metal Saga, which is technically a spin-off, but it's still sort of considered part of the series.
Right. So in Japan, that was Metal Saga Chain of the Sandstorm. So that was actually the first one we got in the US, and the only one until Xeno came out, and then we got Xeno.
Yeah.
But there is 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17. There's like 17 games in the collection, counting the spin-off ones. So even though we don't have a lot of experience with it here, it's been around for a long time, and it's got quite a legacy with it. So I was really excited when we got Xeno, and you know, even more excited to get this tweaked version. So Metal Max is kind of an interesting RPG in that it's a bit more freeform than kind of what your traditional Japanese role-playing game is. It hews a lot closer to, I think, what we've come to expect from a saga game. It kind of just gives you obvious, clear objectives that you're to accomplish, but kind of how you do those and in what order is kind of up to you. And even though it's very clear that there's specific right places to be at different power levels and different party configurations, if you can figure out a way to squirrel past it, you can. It power gates you passively, but it doesn't strongly gate you. It's like one of the examples I will give is early in the game. You know, one of the big focuses of Metal Max is building. You get tanks. So you can run around on foot, but there's larger, more powerful enemies, which will vastly destroy you easily. So there's a whole mechanic where you collect machinery, tanks, and buggies and stuff, which you customize with weapons and different loadouts to explore, like, the post-apocalypse with. And it's great. It's kind of got a bit of Armored Core feel in there. So you have three party members. You can have up to three vehicles at any given time.
And a dog.
And a dog, yeah, and a delightful dog who has a machine gun strapped to his back or whatever. And and you can feed him disgusting bits of mutants that you find in the wasteland. It's like, would you like to feed your dog this giant ant leg? Yes, I would. You know, by the end of the very first major map area, you should have three tanks. And there's a kind of a big bad gatekeeper boss that you can fight. You have a big spider mech dude, and you have a number of opportunities of how you handle him, right? You can fight him, or there's a way that you can climb up on the top of a building and use a rocket launcher to knock him down and flip him on his back, and you can just go right past him and go to the next area. So I chose the latter. I did not fight him, because I only had two tanks. I didn't realize there was a third tank hidden in the big first area until you told me where it was. So I just knocked the spider dude on his back and proceeded to the next area, and then like did a bunch of grinding in the other area, and then came back and killed him with only two tanks. Before you told me a third tank was available in that starting area. I just assumed the next tank would be in the next area. So
I handled that completely differently. So I had found this third tank beforehand, because you can find buried technology using a metal detector that you could purchase like right from the beginning of the game if you have enough money for it. So I found this third tank, and then I went up on top of the building and knocked him off with the rocket launcher just like you did, but instead of running past him, I then used that opportunity of him being on his back to deal some free damage to him and sort of get a head start on fighting him. So, yeah, lots of different ways you can handle encounters like that.
And there's all kinds of examples of that. So, like, another great example is by the end of the first major map era, you should have three party members, right? There's a young mechanic guy, there's like a merchant's daughter, girl, and then your main character, of course. I found the girl near the end of the first area before I had the boy join my party. You can get the boy to join your party by like giving him enough of like the booze you find out in the wasteland and like making friends with him. But if you find the girl first, he joins your party because he has a crush on the girl, and then you get just a party of three immediately. So there's different orders things can be completed in an approach. So it's kind of fun.
I really like this game, and you've sort of drawn comparisons to Final Fantasy XII with this, and I totally agree with that. It's very much Final Fantasy XII with tanks, particularly with the focus on sort of hunting down wanted monsters and getting rewards for them, and taking a sort of freeform approach to exploring and discovering things for yourself. And you always have sort of a long-term goal in mind, but that long-term goal might be go 3 miles in this direction. But like, if you try and follow the marker, there's always loads of stuff in the way. So you end up going around all sorts of things and discovering loads of other things in the meantime. So like those long-term goals really are long-term goals, and it doesn't take you step by step through them. It just says you need to end up over here, and what you do in the meantime is entirely up to you. And I really like that.
Yeah. And like, one of the ways it does kind of gatekeep you mechanically is you'll find sometimes piles of rubble made of different materials, and it'll be like, if you examine them, it'll be like, you need to produce 1200 points of damage output to be able to break this rubble. You know, very early in the first area, there's like an underground dungeon you can find. And then like, when you can only delve so far into that dungeon before you discover a pile of rubble at the back of it, that there's no way you have a weapon as a person on foot strong enough to break that. And there's no way you can get your tanks in the dungeons. The dungeons are on foot only. So, but that dungeon is in the very beginning of the game. So they are very early creating opportunities for you to kind of remember things to return to and explore. And like, who knows what could be behind that rubble? I mean, well, I guess Wikipedia knows, but like, it maybe it's a cool weapon for your tank, or maybe it's a strong piece of endgame armor for the on foot fighting. Like, I don't know, but like, you have to keep in the back of your head that like, I need to return there once I get stronger weapons. And I like games that do that. It has a bit, you know, of that Metroid Castlevania feel to it with returning with different abilities or stronger weapons. I like games like this that hold your hand lightly, give you clear goals, but don't exactly spell out how to achieve them. There's a puzzle-solving strategizing element.
Yeah, so there's like an end marker, but there's no glowing golden trail to follow, basically.
Yeah, exactly. And sometimes it can be quite confusing. So like, in the second area, there's a giant iron wall, and there's obviously one hole in that wall that's big enough to drive your tanks through. But it just happens to be guarded by like a Brachiosaurus with a battleship strapped to its back. So like, you're not getting through there. So what you end up having to actually do is hunt around, and you find a manhole cover that's off. And then you have to get out of your tanks, go on foot. Then you have to go through the sewer on foot. And it turns out the sewer brings you to the other side of the wall. And then and on the other side of the wall, there's a switch you can flip that opens another gate that you can drive through that's far enough from the giant battleship dinosaur where it won't see you go through. But the game didn't put a marker on that manhole cover. The only marker the game gave me was the marker on the other side of the wall that said, you know, you need to get to the other side of this iron wall. You figure it out, bucko. Like, and that's what's cool about Metal Max. It makes you feel scrappy. It makes you feel clever. You know, and when you get that good tank loadout, it makes you feel powerful without feeling. It straddles that line where you feel powerful, but you also don't feel invincible because you've got limited ammo. Yeah. The amount of HP your tank has is a direct correlation between how heavily you have it loaded down with weaponry. So, like, you have to straddle that line between survivability and outright power. It's just a good time.
I think you've played a little bit further than I have, but I really like this game. It's really good. It sort of pushes a lot of the right buttons if you enjoy sort of really customizing your characters and your loadouts and that sort of thing, and exploring and finding things and discovering things and figuring out crazy ways to overcome difficult situations. Like you say, there's generally multiple ways to overcome obstacles that are in your path. You could theoretically try and take on that Brachiosaur with a battleship on its back head on if you wanted to, but then there's also that other way that you mentioned, going around. And that's, there are situations like that earlier in the game as well, like having to sneak past one of the earlier wanted monsters at the right time of day, or going through on foot and triggering a fast travel point so that you can then actually sort of reappear on the other side of the wanted monster and so on. So there's all sorts of creative solutions to problems. And there's never like one set way to play.
Getting the dog is a side quest. You can beat the whole game without the dog. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're a monster if you ignore the quest prompt that it's like, I hear a dog whining over there. But you can. You don't have to have the dog. mm-hmm. even though you want the dog, because the dog somehow on foot does as much damage as your tank does.
Yeah, yeah. And when you and when you're driving around, he just rides on the back of your tank, and that's adorable.
So you, so you were never in a situation like I was, where you had fewer, you had more people in your party than tanks.
No.
Okay.
No,
so if no, you have if you have more people in your party than tanks, the third person also fights on foot like the dog does, even when you're fighting. Like,
yeah.
So like that's why I was texting you frenetically, like, where can I get a third tank? Because Yaki, the mechanic boy, he's just getting pulped out there. Like, I'm getting in these battles with the wanted monsters, and he's just standing there, like, on foot with a handgun. Like, so I have, like, two people in tanks. He's there on foot with a handgun, like, and I just see, like one damage appearing on the bosses, and then the boss is just immediately, like, aggro to him, pulp him to oblivion with like a volley of rocket launcher, and then, yeah. and then like he's dead, and I'm like, I gotta get this poor boy some metal to sit in. So but like he all like the other people, if you don't have enough vehicles, sit on the tank too, like the dog does.
Okay.
So like I like to drive the buggy around when I'm moving because it's faster than the tanks, and like Yaki sits on the back of like the back of those like shelves on the back of the buggy and just like dangles his legs and looks around. It's little touches like that, that show, you know, they put quite a bit of love into building this game.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and I know that unfortunately the planned sequel I think got canceled. It was
Wild West,
I think it was called, and I think it got canceled, which sucks. Yeah, they discontinued development, announced that back in June. So that makes me really sad. So who knows what the future of the series is, but I'm guessing mm-hmm. not great based on that. The dog's got a spinoff, right? They got like a Diablo-style action RPG spinoff.
Yes, it's like a sort of roguelike twin-stick shooter, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, Metal Dogs, it's called. So...
yeah,
I don't know. Did that come west even digitally? I'm not sure.
I think you can get it on Steam now, but I think there's a console release planned.
Okay.
So like, it's definitely on Steam now. It's early access on Steam, so it will probably launch on consoles when early access is finished on PC.
That makes sense. Yeah, I definitely want that. I mean, that's right up my alley. Twin stick mm-hmm. shooter RPG with cute little dogs with machine guns strapped to their backs. Like, this is a very good. This sounds like a very good time to me.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. This has got a very Japanese to English description on it. Harsh battle of the combat dog Pochi begins. Explore dungeons that change every time you enter. Get a wide variety of weapons and power up your dog. Hunt the evil wanted. Enjoy exhilarating action. Enjoy exhilarating battles casually in this shooting action game.
Oh, I love enjoying exhilarating battles casually. It's like what a
harsh battle of the combat dog Pochi.
Oh, yeah. Pochi's amazing. She's like, ah, ah. Like, dog, would you like to pet the dog or feed the dog? I'd like to feed the dog. What is in my inventory? Okay, I have mutant flesh, I have unidentified slime, and I have doggy chow. I'm gonna go with the unidentified slime.
Of course.
Build his immune system up or whatever. Good time, yeah. Like right now, Pochi has a Gauss cannon that shoots lightning strapped to his back. Obviously, every time I defeat a wanted monster and get a ton of money, like my immediate impulse is to ensure Pochi has the best of the best equipment before I even consider my tanks. So like I'm like, I don't know, 10-11 hours in the game, he's already got the best armor and weapons that the shop back at your base can sell you. He has like the $120,000 like black carbon fiber vest on.
Nice.
It's like
nice.
I refuse to let him fall victim to the harsh machinations of the wasteland. Alright, so what else have we been playing? I started Cathedral yesterday. I know that's something that you were also very fond of. That one really crept up on me. That's an excellent game.
Yes, so I mean my main contact with this so far has been the upcoming Evercade version, which I've written the manual for. So I've only played a little bit of it, but what little of it I did play, I absolutely loved. It's got a fantastic soundtrack, lovely art style, very nice gameplay. And you could probably tell us a bit more about it, because I think you've now spent a bit more time with it than I have. So
maybe, I don't know, I just played it for maybe an hour or two last night.
Probably a similar amount to what I've experienced then, because I played just sort of enough to get familiar with the controls and the various options and so on, and then I was fortunate enough to have direct contact with the developer to sort of get other information that might be needed for the manual and so on.
Did you get far enough to get the gauntlet that shoots arrows?
Yes. Okay. Yes.
So yeah, I got about far enough to get that, and then I got, you know, I beat the boss. That's like the arrow puzzle boss in like Zelda fashion. So like I have the arrows, I have the shield, and now I'm just kind of backtracking and exploring a little bit to make sure I have everything in the first cathedral area. And then I found the exit. So like I'm out in like the frosty snow area.
But there's multiple exits from that first area. The frosty area is actually supposedly one of the later stages.
That's good to know.
so there's multiple exits, so just bear that in mind.
Yeah, well, I mean, kind of circling back to what we said about Metal Max, so I found the exit to the snow area before I found the arrow gauntlet. So I was delighted to find out that there was two bosses in the first area and multiple important pieces of gear to pick up just in the first area.
Yeah.
Even like my initial instinct when I started the game was to immediately start going left instead of right. And what I ended up finding was an augmentation for my armor, and then like a dead end where it was clear I couldn't proceed without a different item. So like the game gives you a kind of relative freedom to explore at your own pace, and however you like, and then you're gated by clear power up prompts. But it's really good, and it's hard to explain kind of what makes it feel different from other open-ended side-scrollers with kind of RPG elements. I think my big thing is it feels a bit like Mega Man. Not in the sense that you have like a gun and stuff, because you don't. You have an arrow gauntlet with extremely limited ammunition, but Mega Man always had a very specific feel where you would enter a stage. And in Mega Man, it never paid to just run headlong into the stage. It always paid to stop, look at the arrangement of the platforms, look at the arrangement of the enemies, and kind of puzzle out the safest way to do this. And, you know, maybe you jump on the first platform, shoot the enemy twice, jump on the second platform, shoot the enemy two more times, because the enemy shots come way too fast for you to kill him while you're standing on the first platform. And Cathedral definitely challenges you in a very similar way to know your character's moveset and limitations, how far they can jump, how fast an enemy's projectiles can move, and actually puzzle out the sequence that you're supposed to approach this challenge. And your character is quite fragile, so you're going to die a lot, and you're going to kind of have to memorize and approach these challenge stages with kind of different methods of lateral thinking. And it's really rewarding to beat those challenges, because there's more to it than just reflex. There's a planning element, and I'm really appreciating the kind of the way I think I sent you a message last night about it, and I was like, it's action puzzle, which is something that which is something that is very difficult to pull off in a way that feels good and doesn't feel punishing to the point of masochism. And Cathedral straddles that line quite well. It's challenging in the way that makes me want to come back and keep throwing myself at the challenges repeatedly until I overcome them or think my way around them.
Yeah, definitely. There's a lot of really interesting set pieces and stuff along the way as well, like the bit where you're sort of climbing down a passageway while there's a spiked ceiling coming down on you, and you know there's sort of switches and stuff you need to hit on the way. And so again, you've got to plan your route out really carefully while under this pressure of the scenery coming down on top of you. And then once that's happened, you then have to figure out what to do with that room because the ceiling's still down. So, like, what can you do there now that you couldn't before? Or how do you get around that situation? Or how do you reach places that you would have reached before but you now can't get to? Yeah, lots of really interesting stuff going on right from the very beginning of that game.
Yeah, and it also does something that Metroid, specifically I'm thinking Super Metroid, always did really well, which was kind of this kind of visual, non-verbal storytelling and like hint giving methodology. So
yeah.
I'm thinking of that very early area where you don't have the arrow gauntlet yet, and you kind of walk into this room and there's like this mischievous wizard that like materializes in the air, and like you can't kill him. He's not like an enemy you can fight because he moves too fast, but he just kind of giggles like and like flies off screen, and then you don't see him again for like another like three screens. But you're making your way through this kind of area, and then you come to a door, and you have discovered at that point that there's these switches that you have to hit that will make platforms materialize or dematerialize, and there's a door and there's a doorway with the kind of the dotted outlines where it's clear that some of those blocks have been dematerialized. And right when you're about to get there, the little wizard appears and giggles at you, and he hits the switch and he materializes the blocks, and your path there is blocked, and the switch is on the other side of the wall, so you have no way of hitting that switch. And so it's non-verbally, like visually with animation, keying you into these mechanics. All right, so I definitely have to figure out a way to hit that switch next to progress here. Mm-hmm. So then you have to go through a door that's behind you instead of going forward, and that's what leads you down the whole like pathway to get the arrow gauntlet, because the arrow gauntlet is the way to hit that switch on the other side of the wall. So and you know, there's no like verbal, there's no like text box. It's like the arrow gauntlet is great for hitting faraway switches. Like, it just, you have the arrow gauntlet. As soon as you get it, the next room is full of switches that are far away. So it just coaches you with stage design to learn the application of the tool. So then you're in the room after you get the arrow gauntlet. You're hitting these switches, and that little light bulb goes off, and you're like, oh shit, this is what I need in that little room that had that wizard in it. So then you get really excited to get back to that room and open that up, because there's this incredible setup and payoff in just like a minimalistic, non-invasive way. This game is like really good, classically informed game design done right. Yeah. Like, I'm just so impressed with it.
Yeah. Just to make that sequence even more interesting, the little wizard dude becomes your companion after a while.
Oh, does
he? You can then use him. Yeah, so you can then use him to your advantage in the way that you've seen him take the piss of you.
Yeah, yeah, because he summons the boss, like the arrow gauntlet boss, like the eyeball thing you fight, that big boss. Like, he summons it at you. Like, he's being mischievous. Like, so that's cool. I love those kind of character reversals. I'm thinking of doing a painting of that little wizard, because I love like little robed wizards. I'm thinking of doing a painting of a lot of the sprites from this game. It's got such a beautiful, distinct, enhanced NES feel to it, or old Euro computers. Right, this is a European developer, but it uses black a lot. It uses minimal color palette and tons of negative space to suggest form, and it's very successful. It's hard to describe it without just like overusing meaningless adjectives. Like, it looks good, but the use of negative space is masterful in the graphic design here, and minimal color palette. Just as soon as you boot it up, the music kicks up, and that, you know, me as someone who loves pixel art and loves art and design in games, that initial screen, I was like, wow, there's only four colors here, five colors here counting black. Like, it was quite amazing, I was really happy with it.
Yeah, the whole thing is a real textbook example of the modern retro concept we've talked about before. So it's making use of these conventions and deliberate limitations of old platforms, but then applying modern game design principles and improved technology to those things to make something that feels better to play and runs better than it would have been able to do in the past, but it still sort of has that authentic old school look to it, that old school authentic look and sound to it as well. So like the soundtrack, although it's more complex than something that the NES could have put out, it's still composed using Famitracker. So it's composed using the same sort of tools that people would have used to create Famicom soundtracks. It's just got more instruments in it than you would be normally be able to have. So yeah. It's sort of the equivalent of having one of those enhanced cartridges that the Japanese version of Castlevania 3 came on. So mm-hmm. more sound channels and that sort of thing. So yeah, it's very much been designed right from the beginning to be an authentic feeling retro experience, but one which acknowledges that we live in 2022 now and some things have changed.
Yeah.
And it's a wonderful experience. So that is available now on PC and various consoles, and then it's coming to Evercade in a double pack with Alwa's Awakening in October of this year. So however you want to pick that up, you want to pick that up.
Yeah,
believe me,
that's gonna be a real that's gonna be a real banger of a cartridge too, because I also love Alwa's Awakening, and that's. Yeah. I mean, we could also talk about Alwa's Awakening, but it would just be retreading a lot of the same stuff we just said about Cathedral, because it's excellent in a lot of the same ways.
Yeah, exactly. The interesting thing about the Evercade version of Alwa's Awakening is that while the original release of Alwa's Awakening was designed as a modern retro game like we've just talked about, the version that is coming for Evercade is actually programmed specifically for the NES, but at the same time as being programmed for inferior hardware... it has more stuff in it than the original release. So there's more areas, there's more items to collect. It's a bigger game. It's an enhanced version of the game running on older tech.
Yeah, that's
which
cool.
Is fascinating to me.
Yeah, and I'm glad you told me that, because, I mean, not that I would ever miss an Evercade release because I'm just such a completionist idiot, but this was probably the first cartridge that I've very much considered not getting. Because yeah. I already have the premium edition games physical release of Cathedral on the Switch, which is, by the way, a beautiful release with like a gorgeous yeah. manual that has like silver emboss on the cover, and like it's awesome. But mm-hmm. yeah, I have the premium edition games release of Cathedral, and I have the the Switch physical release of Alwa's Awakening 1 and 2. So yeah. So I was like, I already have these games. I can already play them on TV or handheld because I have them for the Switch. So, like, the motivation for me to get the Evercade version was pretty non-existent. But then I mentioned those concerns to you and explained to me, it's an enhanced and different version of Alwa's with additional content, and B, the Cathedral is the first game running natively on the Evercade. It's not an emulated yes. game. So between both of that, it's still a significant enough release to buy, even if you have those games prior on other consoles.
Yes. Plus, I hear the manual's really, really good.
Yes. It's all the Evercade manuals are extremely well written.
Yes, because they're by me. Anyway.
Full right. disclosure.
Yeah, full disclosure. Yeah, well, I mean, I do the writing. I don't do the layout. I have to give a lot of credit to the folks who do the layout and stuff, because they do an incredible job of squeezing all the information into a teeny tiny space.
Yeah, it's cool.
So, yeah, full props to them. And I really enjoy working on those projects. It's a lot of fun. So, yeah, there will be plenty more of that in the future. So, on a similar note to what you've just talked about with Cathedral Day, I want to talk a little bit about the Succubus series on PC. So, the Succubus series is a range of adult games by a couple of Japanese creators called Pixel Teishoku and Libra Heart. They're 18-plus games, so they've got adult sexual content in them, although several of them do have all-ages, safe-for-work versions. And they're fantastic, absolutely fantastic. I've had my eye on the ones that are available on Steam for quite some time, and I just never got around to picking them up for some reason. But a little while back, I thought, you know what, I'm going to give these a go. I think it was the recent Steam sale or something like that. I thought, you know what, I'm going to finally give these a go. So the ones that are available on Steam, there's four of them, called Castle in the Clouds, Midnight Castle Succubus, Sword of Succubus, and Tower of Succubus. And then there's a couple of other entries in the series that are available on DL site as well, which is the sort of Japanese doujin site.
Okay.
And they have English versions as well. So if you want to play the other games in the series, you can do. You just can't get them on Steam at the moment. So I won't talk too much about all four of them, because I could bang on about these for ages, but these are fantastic examples of exactly what we've just been talking about, modern retro games. So Castle in the Clouds, first of all, is a 2D side-scrolling platformer that's sort of exploration-based. But it's not quite completely open structure, so it's level based, but each level has a very large open map to explore. So the best comparison is probably something like Shantae and the Pirate's Curse.
So you
remember how in that game you go to different islands and each island has its own map and you have to explore each island. Castle in the Clouds is very much like that. So you play this bounty hunter called Liddy, who comes to a town in search of sort of fame and fortune and so on. And you get a series of quests to go to these various different areas and clear out monsters or discover treasures and that sort of thing. And over the course of the complete game as a whole, you unlock various abilities. And there's some really interesting abilities in this, because there's wall climbing and hanging from the ceiling in this, which is something you don't tend to see all that often in games of this type. But it adds a huge amount to interesting level design, because it means that there's sort of ways you can traverse these stages that you wouldn't be able to in a regular sort of platform game. Those systems are really well used to create some stages that are really satisfying to explore. Some really interesting enemy encounters, some great boss fights with sort of screen-filling bosses, all presented in sort of retro-style visuals, but again, using modern tech to do bigger sprites, better animation, just better game design overall. So that's a fantastic one. Also, if you're playing the 18-plus version in that one, there are friendly monsters around the place who are marked with hearts who you can have sex with, and then anytime you have sex with them you set off a screen clearing smart bomb that accords to your lust statistic, so everything on screen suffers the amount of damage that is equal to your lust statistic. So the more you have sex with friendly monsters, the more powerful your screen clearing smart bomb is.
Okay. I'm about it.
Yeah, it's hilarious.
The pixel art, once again, in these games is just, it's so stunning.
It's magnificent. It's really beautiful, yeah. Again, it's sort of slightly better than you might expect from... I'd say Castle in the Clouds sort of looks a bit more like early 16-bit than... Or maybe PC Engine.
Yeah, it looks like PC Engine. It straddles that line between NES and SNES, which is very much PC Engine. Which is like, personally, kind of my favorite aesthetic for this. Like... not quite 16-bit, but way better than the NES could pull off.
Yeah,
like,
definitely.
I love that, like, chunky, but definitely more colors on screen than NES could handle look.
Yeah.
Do we know what they used to make these? Like, engine-wise, did they use any assist tools, or were they, like, programmed ground up, or...
I don't know if it's the same for all of them, but certainly some of them are written in Click Team Fusion.
I'm starting to really think I should learn Click Team Fusion, because my desire to make a horizontal shmup with like a hideous bio-organic aesthetic grows stronger every day. And so like every time I play a game, I'm like, oh, I wonder if this was made in Fusion, because like the inspiration just keeps growing and growing, especially after you told me Freedom Planet was made in Fusion, which is like one of the greatest games in like the past 15 years. So
the nice thing about Fusion is that there is no programming, so everything you do in Fusion is all sort of logic based. So you can either create stuff by sort of letting your game run and then it stops the first time something happens and says, what do you want to happen when these two things collide or something like that? Or you can just go through on a big grid and say, when this happens, this should also happen and that sort of thing. So if you're not used to actually writing code and stuff, Fusion is a really great way to get started. It's for those unfamiliar, Fusion is the successor to titles like Click and Play and the Games Factory, and the actual basic functionality of the software hasn't changed a great deal since Click and Play. The main difference is the amount of things that it's capable of doing out of the box, and the fact that you can bring in all these extensions. So if it doesn't do something out of the box, almost certainly someone will have written an extension to do that for you. So if you're interested in getting started in game development, but the prospect of learning code is a bit daunting for you, it's a really good option. And it often comes up in Humble Bundles and stuff as well, so you can often get it quite cheap.
Yeah, oh, I own it already from a previous Humble Bundle. Yeah, so it's just a matter of stopping dicking around with Final Fantasy 14 and spending my evenings doing something productive for a change.
Yeah, absolutely. I just want to briefly touch on the other Succubus games I've played as well.
Yeah, because they all differ, right?
Exactly. They each have their own sort of distinct thing that they do. So while Castle in the Clouds is a sort of PC Engine style platformer, Midnight Castle Succubus is basically they took Castlevania II Simon's Quest and made it good. So and it's very obviously taking aim for Simon's Quest. Like it uses the same color palette, it uses a lot of very similar looking visuals. They are original sprites rather than just sprite rips from Simon's Quest, but things like the color palette he uses in the towns and stuff is identical to Simon's Quest. But what they've done is they've taken all the stupid bits of Simon's Quest, like you must be holding this red crystal and then kneel in this exact spot for something to happen. They've ditched all that in favor of something that is constantly pushing you forward, making it clear where you need to be, but not necessarily how to get there, and providing plenty of scope for exploration and stuff. And it's a really beautifully designed game.
It kind of loops into what we were talking about with Cathedral and Metal Max before that, right? Like, to me, a hallmark of a well-designed game is that, I know I call it Inception game design, right? Like, a good game passively leads the player in a certain direction, but does so in a way that the player feels like they figured it out themselves. And that to me, is like ingenious game design when that can be done. And it's not common these days.
Yeah, it's quite interesting in Midnight Castle Succubus because it does it in a couple of ways depending on which version you're playing. So there's also the whole thing is split into sort of several discrete areas that have their own musical soundtrack and tile set and that sort of thing. So very, very NES in style. Generally speaking, in each of these areas, you'll reach a point where there's two different ways you can go. And one route will lead you onwards to the next area, and the other route will generally lead you to one of the optional, I guess you'd call them collectibles in the game. There's a bunch of girls that you need to rescue throughout the game if you want to get the best ending. So one route will lead you onwards to the next area. The other route will lead you to the girl you need to rescue. But in order to rescue the girl, you need a key. These are sometimes dropped by bosses. They're sometimes hidden in the environment. They're sometimes hidden in chests and so on. So, it sends you these signals that you might want to go this way, but you might also want to check this way just in case there's something there. If you're playing the adults-only version, the adult scenes in Midnight Castle Succubus only appear when you are going down the route that will lead you to the girl.
Okay.
So you only get load screens when you are heading down this one specific route. So it doesn't tell you this. It doesn't tell you this in the game, but as you're playing, you will gradually come to realize it. And you think, oh, okay, these scenes are only appearing when I'm going in this particular direction. So that must mean that they're a visual cue for me. I don't know how it handles them in the Safer Work version because I haven't tried that version, but certainly in the 18 plus version, that is what they're there for, which I thought was quite interesting. Sword of Succubus is basically the developer going, what if we made a Game Boy Color Zelda with lots of boob fetish scenes in it? because it's an absolutely excellent top-down Zelda game designed with the resolution and color palette of the Game Boy Color in mind, with a few enhancements like a large character sprite at the side of the screen reflecting what you're doing, some wonderfully designed puzzles along the way, some excellent boss fights that are really quite challenging, and plenty of side quests to discover. It's got the real Zelda feel of, okay, I could go straight onto the next dungeon, or if I just wandered around a bit here and see if I could break this wall and go in here, I might find something interesting. And although there's quite a small map in Sword of Succubus, it still took me like 6 hours to play because there was so much interesting stuff to discover that you can ignore if you want to, but you're not getting the full experience of the game if you're not seeking out all these additional things. So that's a really well-designed one. That's definitely one of my favourites. And then the most recent one I've played is Tower of Succubus, which again takes an established formula and brings it up to date. So in this case, it takes the formula of the Tower of Druaga, which is a game I absolutely hate, and makes it playable.
Tower of Druaga is like the classic we always talk. Like, Tower of Druaga is interesting and historically relevant and needs to be played because of that. but it's not actually fun to play.
No, exactly. So what Tower of Succubus does is it takes the same sort of formula of Tower of Draga. So you proceed up this tower, a floor at a time. Each tower has its own sort of self-contained puzzle for you to solve, usually involving getting a key to open the door. And then in a lot of cases, there are optional treasures to find. But whereas Tower of Draga didn't tell you where these optional treasures were or how to get them, unless you're playing the Namco Museum version on Switch, which is one of the best features of that version. Throughout Tower of Succubus, there are little diaries that you find around the place that not only tell the story, they also give you some hints as to where to find these treasures. So it will say, oh, on floor 62, there's this mysterious thing that's happening around here. I don't know what it is, but maybe you want to check it out. And you go and check it out, and there's a useful treasure in there, and so on. And again, it uses these things to give you hints on the bosses as well, and the bosses are all very challenging. And it's just a really nicely designed game. And again, it takes a distinctive retro aesthetic. In this case, it takes the NES style, so it's a bit higher resolution than Sword of Succubus was. Has its own very distinct visual audio presentation, and it's just a great game. So these four games are absolutely fantastic. Sword and Tower, you need to be on board with the adult content because it's not optional in those ones. Okay. Because part of the nature of the game in those ones is that you are playing a succubus. And so part of the game mechanics involves having sex with things to restore your magic and life and that sort of thing. So you need to be on board with that sort of thing. Midnight Castle Succubus and Castle in the Clouds, like I say, there are safer work versions available that strip out the adult content. So if you're a bit on whether or not you want to see some of the scenes in these games, which can get a little bit brutal, those first two games are probably the ones I would recommend people explore first. But they're all good. They're all excellent games. They're all fantastic examples of the fact that adult gaming doesn't have to just be visual novels. There is a lot of stuff out there that is incorporating adult content in quite a solid sort of way, with sort of more traditional game design as well. Yeah. So these were a really, really pleasant discovery for me. They are sort of real top tier indie stuff for me now.
I think that's, you know, really interesting to even consider, because I think that's kind of the stigma that a lot of eroge and adult games kind of get, is it's like it's visual novels only. It's like only an excuse for the pornographic content. But the fact of the matter is, you know, as you've explored on your website for years, it's like you have full-fledged RPGs like the Rand Saga. Even shmups, you know. I'm thinking of Steam Hearts, which is like a classic, collector sought after shmup available on the PC Engine that has kind of mild erotic scenes in it as stage clear rewards and stuff. But it the fact that a game is an adult game or a pornographic game is not necessarily 100% a statement that the game is not a focus of the game. Sometimes it's sometimes it is truly a well-designed game and the adult content is just part of the flavor of the overall game's design.
Yeah.
And I think for that reason, from a historical and a modern analysis standpoint, it's a whole subgenre that requires much greater attention than it's ever historically gotten.
Yeah, definitely. I think probably Sword of Succubus was the most interesting one in this regard, because I can't remember the last game where I played a female character who was this sexually empowered.
That's important.
Because pretty much every sexual encounter in Sword of Succubus in particular is initiated by you. It is your character deciding that she wants to have sex with someone, and she does it. And she's not ashamed of it. She's not sort of she's not worried about people looking down on her. She's not worried about people judging her. It's just something that she does. And that also extends to one of the core game mechanics, where you have armor and it can break. And so when your armor breaks, she's just walking around naked. She's a succubus. She doesn't care if she's walking around naked, but everyone else does. So you try and talk to an NPC while you're naked, and they won't be able to deal with you because they're just too busy ogling your tits. but at the same time, there's also a dungeon later in the game where you need to be naked in order to pass a ritual and so on. So that's, again, that's used in sort of interesting ways along the way. And at the same time, the character who doesn't say anything throughout the whole game, she's just personified as this person who is extremely confident in her body, extremely confident in her sexuality. And it just comes across as a really sort of positive representation. And yet, I'm sure there are people out there who just be like, "Oh, it's a game with a naked chick in it."
Yeah, well, I think that's an important that's an important distinction to make, because I mean, we've talked pretty extensively off cast about these games, and I have some hesitancy to play them, because although I really like, I don't know the way I would phrase it right to distinguish it, but like, I really like sexy games, quote unquote, right? I really like anime, adult content, but I'm more into like the pin-up-y cheesecakey stuff, and I find that like full-on hentai in general just often veers too close to non-consensual sex. And I don't like that. I don't want that. Yeah. I don't want to see that. I don't want to engage with that content. So to hear that the sexuality as represented in these games is a bit more on that side, or entirely on that side, where it's not the situation where the woman is empowered and powerful, that's a tremendously important distinction to make for someone like me.
Yes.
Because then I wouldn't be off-put or uncomfortable with that. I think media that engages with adult content, specifically kind of this Japanese style media, perhaps even from a marketing standpoint, might want to do a better job of being very clear about the type of sexuality represented in the work.
Yes.
Because I'm thinking, I'm thinking just from my standpoint, and you know, this is something that I've learned in the past year or so, because you know, we've gotten into watching a lot of VTubers, but it's been a genuine surprise with me as I've delved deeper into like the anime and gaming communities, how many women in the community are also extremely into adult content. It's not it's not just a male thing, but you know, a lot of the women I speak with in the community have similar leanings towards me, although they love sexualized content, representations of nudity and sex and sexuality in their media, they don't like the kind of general thrust that hentai has to move towards rape. And I think these actual developers would probably make more money if they figured out a way to like categorize or phrase descriptions of the sexual content in your games so that the assumption wasn't made. Because the industry has backed itself into that corner, but through better communication, they have the ability to market their works more appropriately to people like me who hesitate to buy adult games, even though they have an inclination towards sexualized content, for fear of stumbling upon content like that they don't want to see.
Mm-hmm. There are, I think, three things I want to say about this. First of all, do be aware that some of these games do still have some non-consensual scenes in them. So be aware of that, particularly in the case of the adult versions of Castle in the Clouds and Midnight Castle Succubus in particular. And Tower of Succubus as well. I think in that regard, Sword of Succubus is probably the quote-unquote mildest of them. There are still a couple of scenes in there that might make you feel a bit uncomfortable. At the same time, one thing worth considering is that these games are based on sort of horror tropes, and particularly Japanese horror tropes as well, which often involves sexual horror and that sort of thing. And yes, absolutely, that may not be something you're into, and I completely understand that sort of thing. I'm not super into it either, but I can sort of kind of handle it if it comes up, if you know what I mean. It's not something that will put me off entirely. It's not something I love seeing, but it's at the same time, it's not something that will put me off entirely, because I tend to look at it as the sort of thing that, okay, this is a dark game. This is a dark game that is based around the idea of a succubus. It makes sense for there to be horrific sexual scenes in there.
Sure, yeah.
As I say, your mileage may vary on that. That's not a universal truth. I'm not trying to say that anyone is wrong for bouncing off these games because of those scenes. But I do want to make that clear for anyone who is interested in checking these out. Do be aware of that content.
Yeah, your mileage may vary based on your own life experiences and what you've dealt with. But I think, you know,
exactly.
I'm not always a fan of like slapping trigger warnings, quote unquote, with things, but just as a person who has friends who have been victims of sexual assault, I'm not the type of person who says these works don't have a right to exist or these depictions don't have a right to exist, but I do think it's important. I do think it's important that the works be marketed in such a way that the content is extremely clear, so that
definitely.
It doesn't hurt anyone's enjoyment or cause any distress in the player. I love Berserk, so like I'm not here to say there's no place for narratively driven portrayals of rape in
right.
media, but it's up to the creators of the content as to how that is portrayed, and that can dictate whether or not it's a valid piece of that media. I didn't want to turn this into a whole debate about like representation
of
sexuality in gaming and stuff, but I think these things don't get discussed with the nuance they deserve and kind of the measured level head they deserve. And make no mistake, the adult side of game development has been in existence since the game development's been in existence. Fucking Custer's Revenge on the Atari, right?
Yeah.
It's always been a part of the industry, but it's something that's never really spoken of with the same level of reverence or attention. And, you know, largely that's just because of, like, Western society's taboo on sexuality, but I don't want to write like a PhD thesis on this, but I respect the work you and some of your compatriots at Rice Digital are doing to actually dive into and treat adult games with kind of some of the scrutiny and the respect that they deserve as parts of the industry that don't normally get discussed.
So this, what you've just said there actually ties in really nicely with the other two things I wanted to say on this subject, which was, first of all, we had a really good letter for the Rice Digital Friday letters page this week, which the author actually subsequently retracted because they were worried it put too much personal information in. But it made such interesting points that I rewrote it and published the main points of the letter without identifying the original person, if you see what I mean. So I paraphrased it. Because their point was that there had been numerous examples of works that had tackled quote-unquote difficult subject matter. So they cited a couple of examples of English visual novels that had featured non-optional rape scenes and non-optional scenes of things like suicide and stuff like that that you couldn't avoid, and that certain parts of the audience had sort of raised a big fuss over because they couldn't avoid these scenes. And there was sort of a really weird combination of responses to these scenes, because there were some critics who were saying that, you should be able to deal with difficult subject matter, particularly if it's difficult queer subject matter, which it was in both of these cases. It was to do with sort of queer issues as well as suicide and rape and that sort of thing. And so this letter author's kind of feelings on the subject was that trigger warnings do have a place, but not just for the main reason that they tend to get used. And that is that not only are they useful for telling people who are sensitive about these things, who do have sensitive mental health issues that might cause them to have sort of trauma or anything like that based on past experiences or past experience with their friends and so on. As well as that, one thing worth bearing in mind is that there are people who are into this sort of thing. There are people who are into specific types of fantasies. It doesn't mean that they want to do them in reality or anything like that. It doesn't mean that they're bad people or anything like that. But there are people who are into fantasies such as rape and that sort of thing who want to know when there is a piece of media that actually caters to those fantasies, if you see what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well,
and I think that's a really interesting point that I hadn't really considered all that much, but it also ties in with a discussion that I had on Twitter recently with someone who got in touch recently after reading my previous coverage on Rants, because they're also studying Rants and doing some videos on it. And we had a really interesting discussion about how the Rants series, which is of course very notorious for its numerous rape scenes, we had a really interesting discussion about how Rants handles these things, because in Rants there is a very clear distinction between what this video maker described as non-consensual fantasy and violent scenes of sexual assault. Because those are two very different things. And they are both present in Rants. And they are both handled very differently and very well.
Sure.
Because what happens in Rants is any of these scenes that involve Rants, the main character who is supposed to be the player, they fall into the non-consensual fantasy category. And so people who are interested in that kind of fantasy, but kind of want to, I guess, tone down the brutality side of it, I guess is how you describe it. It's a difficult subject to describe, particularly as a man. But yeah, people who are interested in that sort of thing as a fantasy are catered to by the scenes that involve Rants in that regard. Mm-hmm. And yet at the same time, there are scenes in that game that are designed to be horrific. They are designed to be shocking as part of the narrative. They are designed to be horrible. They are designed to make you feel uncomfortable. And Rants does an amazing job of distinguishing those two types of experience on what is very similar subject matter, and subject matter that is often completely shied away from by people who comment on and criticize this sort of thing.
The bottom line is, you know, as with many things we often discuss on here, especially when we go deeper into like sociological topics and like game narrative and presentation like this, is sex and sexuality, perhaps more than anything we've discussed, is such a topic full of A, personal investment, and B, infinite layers of nuance, that it is literally impossible to cover all contingencies with the simple black or white layers that that people who don't engage with but presume to judge often apply to these things. So I don't, and once again, I don't want to make it into a whole debate or discussion about, you know, that and the current, you know, broader zeitgeist embrace or lack of embrace of sexuality in popular media. But it's an immature mind that it refuses to acknowledge and factor in the extreme amounts of gray areas and myriad viewpoints that are part of the nuance of human sexuality. It's just, it's a very difficult topic to cover maturely, and it's one games actually do a lot better than people give them credit for.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mean, there are a lot of games that handle it badly. You can see a lot of them in the new releases section on Steam every single day. but at the same time, there are a ton, such as the ones we've described today, and plenty of others who handle it fantastically. And there is so much to talk about with these things, and it really irks me that they don't get talked about enough. It is only specialist sites like Rice and other sites who are willing to cover this sort of thing, who are seemingly even interested in considering that there might be some nuance in this topic.
Yeah, I don't know. It's so hard because of the way we're raised, specifically in the West. Yeah. To think of sexual content as such a taboo. But I think, you know, in recent history, and like I mentioned, thanks to a lot of the VTubers we're fans of, like, I've come to be more okay with being overt about how much I like certain, you know, bits of adult content. Because for me, it's just always been, you know, part of the taboo and part of never discussing it. It's just like, this is a guy thing. You know, like, everyone wants to jump on your buns about the male gaze and shit. But then, like, I think about the time, remember I was telling you a while ago, Niji Sanji and Fanana Ryuga, she's such a wonderful kind of advocate for this. She just kind of takes the gravity out of sexual content. It's very, like, oblique about how much she enjoys it. And I think there's such an endearing honesty to the way that she discusses it openly, engages with it in a humorous way that kind of takes the fear and taboo out of it. I'm thinking of the one episode, I think I remember telling you about this once, that she was playing Nekopara on stream, and she was
describing the adult scenes to her viewers with like a filter on, just like not like using series of like coded language that she described. So like when it was like an oral sex scene, she was like, she just like narrated it as like, and now she is consuming the French fry and like stuff like that. So it's just like this stuff is only as scary as we make it.
Yeah.
you know, because I don't know. You know, obviously the bedroom is private and sexuality is a very personal thing, but taboos exist because taboos are built.
Yeah, exactly.
So when, you know, people like Fanana Ryuga are kind of at the forefront of destigmatizing some of this type of media and showing that, like, you can be a kind, generous, intelligent person who just likes smut. Like,
yeah,
and it's great, and it's I think it's helped me and a lot of other gamers be less ashamed and feel less shitty about that part of themselves.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I think that's really valuable. So, I remember sort of when English VTubers first became a thing, I was pleasantly surprised at how many of them talked about how much they liked Erige, Boys Love, Yaoi, manga, that sort of thing. Because that was always sort of like the great secret. I mean, over the course of the last maybe 10 or 15 years or so, I think people on the internet in general have become a lot more open about talking about this sort of thing. Like, if I think back to when I first discovered hentai back in the late 90s, and how much I enjoyed it, but also how shameful I found it, because I didn't want anyone to know that I was into this stuff, but I still enjoyed it. And I think about now, where I'm quite happy to talk about it, and I'm sort of, I don't know if proud is the right word, but I guess I am proud in certain ways about how willing I am to talk about this sort of thing, and how willing I am to write about this sort of thing. And people are grateful for it. I get lots of messages quite regularly complimenting me and thanking me for talking so openly about this sort of thing and not being judgmental about it, and considering that there might be some nuance to this sort of discussion and that kind of thing. So it's something that I think has improved over the course of the last decade or two, but there's obviously still a way to go. But I think things are improving. And as you say, I think VTubers have a significant role to play in that as well. So yeah, thanks to them for all the things they do.
Always. Thanks. Thank you, Ryuga, for making my life better.
Yes, she is very good for that sort of thing. Anyway, right, we've gone on for an hour and a quarter so far. Is there anything else you want to bring up?
No, I don't think so. I mean, just in general, got a lot of other games I'm hoping to explore to talk about on the next cast. Along with my copy of Cathedral, I also received a copy of Phenotopia, which is another open platform side scroller that I knew nothing about until Premium Edition Games started advertising they were selling copies of it. But upon looking at videos of it, I fell in love immediately with the aesthetic of it, the general speed and cadence of the animations. So I'm very much looking forward to hopefully engaging with that the next few weeks and being able to speak to it. Because if my instincts are right on the video footage I've seen, I think it's really going to be one that a lot of people have passed by, but really, really should play. Yeah, excited to report on that. I've also been diving pretty deep as a fan of strategy RPGs into Chroma Squad, which is a game that quite a lot of people enjoyed when it first came out, but I've just kind of been getting around to checking it out. And that's a game with a lot of moving parts. So I'm not super comfortable talking about, you know, what's great about it from a design perspective yet, but hopefully by our next episode, I should be able to speak to that with a little bit more authority. So yeah, a lot, just, you know, as we often say when we text each other, right, embarrassment of riches. Every day I'm a new game show up. I just got my copy of Live Alive.
Yo, lovely. Yeah.
It's 2022 and I can now play Live Alive in English. What? What? Yeah, it's just
fantastic.
Life is, you know, as we often say, we are simultaneously living in the worst possible and best possible timelines. Because you've got a handheld PC that can play Arcade Perfect Night Slashers. And I've
and I've got 326 Switch games that, and like 30 of them, and like I'm probably, I don't know, more than 30 of them. I don't know, like half of them are Metroidvanias. It's like the kids today talk about living their best life. Like, yeah, me sealed in my basement with Cathedral is Lee living my best life. So, yeah, just I'm grateful every day for the directions certain parts of the industry are moving in, and how people like, you know, people like the folks at Blaze with the Evercade and the indie scene. For every negative news story we hear about fucking Squaresoft packaging NFTs with their action figures, we can always we can always circle back around and talk about something like Chroma Squad and know that there are games out there being made by people who actually have a genuine love for the craft. And it's really heartening to me.
Yeah, I had a couple of other things penciled in to maybe talk about today, but I think we probably rattled on for long enough today, so I'll save these for next time. But I just want to give a brief mention to the fact that I started playing No Man's Sky again and have been enjoying it a great deal.
Yes, I've been curious about that after all the extensive updates.
Yeah, so it's had like 20 major updates since I first played it, so I was curious to see, one, how much it's changed, two, if it's still actually playable as a effectively a newcomer, and I've been having a great time with that so far, so I'll talk a bit more about that next time. The other thing that I picked up this week was Capcom Arcade Second Stadium on Switch. Lot of really cool stuff in there, a lot of really obscure stuff in there as well, which is really pleasing to
I
see.
I think that one's getting a physical release in Asia.
Interesting.
I don't think the first one did, but I think the new one is.
That's a shame.
Yeah, it is a shame. Maybe it'll happen if there's enough demand, but I don't even know what's on the new one. What's on the new one?
The ones I've written down, obviously there's a lot more than this, but the ones I particularly wanted to talk about was a compile puzzler called Panikis, which I don't know if you've ever heard of, because I certainly hadn't, but it's fantastic.
I recognize the name, but I don't think I've ever played it.
It's a bit like Puyo Puyo, but not quite.
Okay.
Super Puzzle Fighter 2 Turbo, which I'm sure you're familiar with.
It's one of the greatest video games ever made. Period.
Exactly. Block Block, which is a really nice breakout game. And Eco Fighters, which is a really interesting shooter.
Oh, Eco Fighters is amazing. Is that also the one that has Three Wonders on it?
Yes.
I'm obsessed with Three Wonders and have been for like my entire life. So, I have to get it too, just for Three Wonders.
All right, so we'll save some more detailed discussion about that for next time, because, well, you may have a copy by then and we may have more to talk about. But we shall see. Anyway, I think we'll leave that there for today, because my throat's getting a bit dry, and it's 4 o'clock and I haven't had lunch, so we should probably fix that.
Yeah, you too.
Anyway, well, we did get up at midday, to be fair, so, you know, it's been a very long, hot week, so we had a extensive lie-in this morning.
I imagine you're just hibernating through the heat, right?
Pretty much.
Understandable. Yeah. I see the news, and I'm like, I have to make sure Pete isn't melting. Like, I have to check in with him.
Well, we're melting a bit, but we're okay for the minute. It has cooled down a little bit now, so hopefully we won't have something like we had on Monday and Tuesday this week again.
It's supposed to be like that here where I am. Like, today and tomorrow are supposed to be like 100 plus Fahrenheit, brutal.
Ugh. Not good. Not good at all. Anyway, would you like to tell people where to find you online?
Yes, you can always find me on Instagram at ccaskyart.com for my artwork, and at Chris Buys Plastic for photography of my action figure and video game collections. I just recently started a new project. Well, I'm actually going to be doing a painting of Ina from Hololive English, her sprite from Holocure. So it's a really, really fun project. I'm really excited to start. So I'll be posting kind of work in progress shots of that. And I am also in the final parts of finishing up the painting I've been working on for the past few weeks this weekend. So I'll be sharing I'll be sharing pictures of that on there very soon. And that piece will be available for sale. So make sure to give me a follow at ccaskyart and Chris Buys Plastic if you don't already.
Cool. And you can find my daily writing over at ricedigital.co.uk. Rice Digital got a YouTube channel where we're posting occasional gameplay videos as well. There's my personal YouTube channel where you'll find various retro gaming videos running on a roughly monthly cycle, exploring Atari, Commodore, and various other bits and pieces of retro, including Evercade games. And if you want to follow me on Twitter, you can get me at MoeGamer. I think that's everything. So just remains for us to say, as always, thank you very much for watching and or listening, and we'll see you again next time.